accession number 26561, reel 21.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 21. We've talked about your time as Inspector of Radio Services, or Radio and Radio and Wire, you know, all of the technical services of that line, the communicators. But that was between 1959 and 63. That's quite a long posting.
Yes, I was extended for that.
And what the next thing, you then go on, I think probably the next thing is to go on to when you were commanding officer of the Tactical Communications Wing, which has a worldwide, again, scope. Can you talk a bit about that? That sounds really important.
Yes, at the end of having spent 3 years flogging around the world on technical inspections, I was then posted as CEO of the Tactical Communications Wing, and this was... You must realise that if a contingency occurs anywhere, the first thing you must have to get the aeroplane in is a ground radio and radar system and an air traffic control and so on. You have to set up a miniature station, airfield station, and that is the job of the Tactical Communication Wing. You have giant radars to be put up and all sorts of worldwide transmitters to be put up. In fact, we laid on a demonstration of a typical forward airfield. We had to be parachutable into locations to start them off. And they were called BASOs, Brigade Air Support Units, which were parachutable into position with our Land Rover with all its radios in it on a parachute, and that would go to the forward and join the army and tell back the requirements from the Air Force to support the army. They needed an air traffic control setting up with its small radar, Eureka radar, and air-to-ground transmitters, receivers, an HF for a headquarters, a worldwide headquarters for anywhere in the world to communicate with, a telephone exchange, and tentage generators, and a whole lot. And in fact, we used to lay on a display in front of the hangar where we were down at Tangmere, that would show all the speed and availability. The whole thing would be packed into a Beverly aircraft, including the parachutables. We didn't actually parachute, we just taxied round and opened in front of the reviewing officers, which were frequently admirals or brigadiers from America and so on, who would all come and watch this display. And from the time the doors of the Beverly opened and the two BASO Land Rovers raced out with their equipment and set up in a nearby location, a mile away from the center, then we would have a worldwide communication. Everything had to be set up: tents, aerial masts, generators, air traffic control with plexiglass windows, all tentage, and an exchange which was packed into a special air transportable container.
And this would all be parachuted down?
No, the parachuting was the BASO only. They go to the forward positioning. The other would arrive by the first aircraft that came in. We immediately established a communication on landing where they would throw a rope with a weight on it over the thing and pull up an aerial on a tree or a windsock and then transmit on a single sideband worldwide receiver suitcase form with a Honda generator, and then within minutes of landing would be in communication, and then they would get the aircraft early aircraft that could fly in the bigger stuff.
Now, was this ever needed?
Many times.
Can you give us an... I mean, you've got something about the Zambian airlift, which is the best one to
oh, the Zambian one was typical. But I'd say for this demonstration, we'd lay on this display the whole lot and we'd run out with a handset to the senior officer who was watching all this and said, would you like to speak to the Met Centre at Aden or at Malta? And they could have their choice of which... And the whole of this, tentage, aeromast, generators working, everything camouflaged. Chaps have still got rifles on their back, two watches, and the whole thing was set up in 8.5 minutes.
That's pretty amazing.
It was. I wanted to get them on the, what was it called, the Royal Tournament. It would have made a good impression, I think. But they were trained and trained and trained in all weathers. And that was typical of the tactical communication. Without them, the aeroplanes don't get on the ground. And a very important starter for any contingency. A typical contingency, I'd had three years in charge of this, and one on Christmas Day, 11 o'clock in the morning, and my telephone rang. I was 38 Group Support Unit then, and my telephone number was 3838. And they said, Dave, get your wing out to Zambia. And I said to them on the phone, I said, well, tell me after Christmas, this is Christmas Day. No, we said now. And fortunately, I'd laid on an ops room with a centre that could be assembled, and all the various contingencies from all over the world, various patterns of contingencies were all ready and available. Every man knew which piece of the jigsaw puzzle was his and how to fit it together. And so I said, well, tell me after Christmas. They said, no, now. And I alerted my ops room immediately, which was manned over Christmas Eve. It was real fire brigade type of pattern of operation. And they got cracking. And remember, there's very little transport on Christmas Day. Not all the troops had their telephones in their houses. I got the police and various kind uncles to the lads who were coming, and I got the whole lot in. They grabbed their own package of the communication piece and right down to the spare pencils and spare light bulbs each, and the whole of the equipment. And we were in Zambia on Boxing Day, ready to start the assembly.
And what year was this? 66?
Yeah.
And it went well, the assembly?
Oh, very well. And I was going all around Africa setting up radio stations, for which I was awarded the MBE. For example, I wanted to put in... We were flying in oil, which was bigger than the Berlin airlift, this function. I, for example, went all around the various parts of Africa setting up radio stations, sometimes in a clandestine form of in civvies. And I went to my air commodore and had no success with the Belgian Congo people in Kinshasa, in Zaire. And he said, you go, Dave, you can cope on the French, can't you? I said, yes. And he said, well, go there and get permission to site a radio station, one of these worldwide single sideband stations on the edge of their airfield. And I went there. Somebody said to him, don't go armed, because they'll kill you for your revolver. So I went there, and I didn't know quite how I'd do it. I thought I'll find out where the War Office is and go there. So I eventually found out where I went to the War Office, and the doorman wouldn't let me in. And then I said who I was and what I was doing and so on. And he said, oh, well, all right then. And I go upstairs in the second office on the left. And I went up there, and I was a character there, Lieutenant Colonel. And I was chatting with him in French, and he said to me, my English is better than your French. And I said, oh, fair enough, great, you know. And I then discovered that he'd been an RAF officer during World War II. And of course I couldn't but do well after that. And I said, I want permission to cite a bunch of civilians. They're really soldiers, but they'll be in civilians on your airfield, because they, at that time, they had mercenary in the Congo, they had mercenary men and so on. And he said, well, there's only one person who can get permission for that, is President Mobutu. And I said, well, how the hell do I get to see President Mobutu? He says, you're in luck. He's got an office in this building, which he keeps in close touch with his War Office. And so I went there, and I, again, it was all done in French with the Mobutu. I explained that we were bringing in fuel for his neighbours in Zambia, and would he help us by letting us put up a radio station to bring the Canadian aircraft across and into Zambia. And he agreed it, and he said to this half colonel, he said, tend to it. And so I got his approval, and we set up. And then I set up stations in Kenya.
And that country was Mobutu's country. That's Belgian Congo.
Yeah. Was, yes.
Yeah, I don't know what it's called now. I interrupted
Leopoldville, you. And, yeah.
And where else?
Zaire is its proper name, yeah, now. And at that time it was Zaire.
And several other countries such as that?
Yes, I went to Dar es Salaam, and the local people there set the boys up in a lovely hotel, and they really had a lovely time on that one. And, you know, they lived off lobsters and things like that. And I was very pleased for them, and they had a room in the hotel to live in, and they had to keep a 24-hour watch at the 6x6x6 cabin that was air transportable, with the UHF SSB in it. And then it was in Nairobi. I had a station up there, and another one. And then I tried to get one in names down on the east coast of...
doesn't matter.
Yeah, but all around, places around Africa where we need it. Because Africa's a big place. You can put the whole of America and Europe on it, and still have, and India on it in a jigsaw fashion. And it's huge. So we really needed radio guidance for these characters flying in fuel to the thing. And Harold Wilson came out to inspect it, and he got rude responses from the boys who were sweating like hell, loading barrels of petrol into aircraft and chaining them up and handling them, working around the clock. I was doing an 8-10 hour a day regular, 7 days a week, and that set up. Going around to names.
Doesn't matter. We're not in that stage of detail now.
No.
Were there any other mobilisations, or was that the main one during the 3 years?
That'd be one of the major ones, yes. So we did one in British Guiana. We also had a very good photographic intelligence in our set up in the ops room. I used to send characters out on likely stormy places, which I'd get the wire from the Foreign Office. Things were bubbling in that area. And I send somebody out with a camera, and phone all the likely spots around the air traffic control and so on. In fact, my library of photographs of places around the world was so good that the MI5 used to come to my library to see what I'd got. But when I'd send a man out to do a recce on possible places of eruption, I'd give him 8 rolls of film. I said, I want pictures on all these when you come back. And then I had another one on another occasion when they were doing the Seychelles. And this time I'd gone to MOD on my third tour. And I said to the, he was a good character. And he,
hang on, have we drifted away from the tactical communications wing?
Yes, he's still tactical communication. The calibre of the sort of things that they did. He went into the Seychelles with a rubber dinghy, a thing full of petrol, a can full of petrol, and a Honda, and he went ashore with the geographical people.
But that wasn't during your time.
Yeah, I was in the... Oh, I see what you're saying. But I'm saying that's a typical thing that he would do.
Well, let's move on to it. You left them in 1966, and then you seem to have taken a variety of... even in your own thing, your abridged CV, you don't detail the appointments between 66 and when you left in 75.
No.
Could you just sort of take us through this period of staff appointments generally? Then they're with NATO, they're with the MOD, as you said, your third stint with them, and various RAF headquarters. If you could sort of summarise your work in the time.
Let's start with... I think after the tactical communication, yes, I did another Air Ministry tour, but this is very short because I got promoted to Wing Commander during that, and they posted me to NATO, to Fontainebleau, where I'd done the original paradrop. Pardon me. On my annual report, you have a blockage which says, what would you like for your next posting? And I've been putting NATO in there for the last 10 years. And the fact that I spoke, or could cope with French, and they posted me to Fontainebleau in France, of course, that is, yes.
What do you remember of that posting?
Oh, very much. It is a lot. I had an interesting job. I was called the head of...
We're bogging down into details that you don't remember, if you see what I mean. So,
yes.
I mean, if you keep it more general, because we won't know what you're... You know.
Oh, controller of equipment and personnel was my NATO appointment, and I had staff of various Germans. I had 7 German officers on it, and a few Brits. Quite interesting job. My job there for the whole of NATO was providing the equipment and personnel for that job. It was an interesting job, and when we were at Fontainebleau, I was in the officers' mess there one day, and there were a group of Germans talking together, and I overheard them, and one of the Germans, Hans Goldmann, his car had broken down in Limoges, and he was trying to get his other brother officers to take him down there. He said, otherwise I've got to go up to Paris and down the line, it'll take me probably 2 days to do it. By the time I collected my car down one day, he said, it's dreadful. He said, if I could hire a car, which I can't afford, I'd do it all in a day. And I overheard this, and I went over to him and I said, I could give you a lift. And he looked at me as if to say, what's in it for you? And I said, well, you can provide the petrol coupons, and that's all I'm asking. And he did that. He was delighted with that and became quite a good friend. And he said to me one day, he said, "You know, Dave," he said, "during the war," he said, "I was based as a sergeant in Fontainebleau." I said, "Yes, so was I." He said, "Oh, no, this was during the occupation." I said, "Yes, I was parachuted into the Hippotique to set up the radios in Fontainebleau." And he said, "Well, I had troops out all over the place." And I said, "Well, you didn't do a very good job, did you?" Anyway, we became very good friends, and I helped him. And I made friends with a lot of Germans. The other one was, my general was a German general, General Kluger, whom I had met at a meeting previously in Paris during one of their lectures. And I saw him. They were new into, the Germans were new into NATO, and they were a bit like a bunch of schoolboys at their first school. I went over to them and introduced myself, and this major there was Major Kluger, and I sort of took him under my wing, and him away around NATO headquarters and so on, and we became very good friends. 3 years later, he was my general in Fontainebleau. And anyway, everybody, de Gaulle kicked the AFSENT headquarters out of France, and they went up to Holland and Belgium, except for yours truly, who was detailed to stand behind, and most of the complex things were radio equipments and so on, and installations. And I was told I would be handing all these back to the French government, including the Maginot Line, which was held as a underground headquarters for AFSENT in the event of a war. And I had this job of going round and the various microwave stations, which were all brand new to NATO spec and had beautiful brick buildings with a large hall and surrounding offices, a kitchen, a bathroom, a workshop and so on, around this brand new building. There was a chain of eight of them down through France because the communications were so poor at that time. And I'd go to the farm. I was given a Commandant Baby, that's Major, spelt Baby, B-A-B-Y, and he represented the French government, and I was representing the Brits. And I had to go around all these places and formally hand them over. And we'd go to one of these microwave stations, which is on rented farmer land, and said to the farmer, "You can have this for 1,000 francs, which is peanuts, wouldn't pay for the paperwork." And he said, "No." And he said, "I want compensation for what you have done to my land." And he had a broken-down farmhouse a few hundred yards away. And there we said, "Sorry," and Bebby and I were together on this. And we all wonderful, very good rapport. We got on famously. And he went round and he said, "Well, you're going to have to give me a firm answer, but I'll let you stay overnight." And we nip off to a hotel for that night and come back next morning. Said to the farmer, "You have no options. You either say yes, you would like to buy it for 1,000 francs, or you say no." And he said, he put no, and on the signed it on the no, "I don't want it. I want compensation for what you have done to my land." So we said, "Oh dear." And this beautiful building, quite large, holds to hold a very big family of people with hard standing, water, drainage, everything was built in there. And this beautiful building was, we had a regiment of Belgian engineers allocated to us, and they came in with their bulldozers, hoses and shovels and things, and put it all on the back of lorries and carted it away. and harrowed his land with nothing other than earth on it and presented it back to him. But that happened to six of the eight stations down there. They all wanted compensation and the house.
So what, I mean, that,
oh,
that's...
Then I was, I thought, you know, when they moved up to Holland, all the Americans had their big station wagons loaded up with everything they could, all on the starter's line, ready to race up there when the moment they were released. And they all gathered up, and I thought, well, there'll be no houses left for me when I get there. I had a squadron leader, a Cripper, Brit, with me to help me with all this. And the funny part about it was, when I'd finished, and I handed back the Maginot Line, which was interesting. It had been looked after by the Royal Corps of Signals, and they'd done a beautiful job on this automatic exchange, making handmade parts, because it was so ancient, for that, and everything gleamed and worked beautifully. I'm very proud to hand that back to the French. They also, the Americans had an eight position bowling alley. It cost £1 million, I suppose. It's such a giant entertainment piece. And they offered it to the French again for peanuts, and they said, no, we're not going to do it. So they came in and they blew it all up. The only thing the Brits had provided was a hospital, and they wouldn't blow that up, of course. But somebody else had provided a swimming pool, and that too was just blown up and left.
Now, any other big things from this period of various postings at the Air Ministry, NATO, and with the RAF generally?
Yes.
Any other big jobs that you remember?
This was the last thing I did.
You seem to have started specialising in satellite communications and message switching computers. I mean, what's that about?
Yes, that wasn't the last thing I did. I went back to MOD, which, you know, the MSG had become part of MOD then, and I was responsible for planning various things and to do with signals equipment and new types of equipment and new systems. And one of my things that I wrote was a computerized message switching system. And the financier, although I could get money for development of this and getting it done, they wouldn't let me go wholesale on it, although I promised to give them a reward of not personnel instead of machinery in place, instead of a lot of personnel. For instance, the Haydock switching centre, which was up at Haydock by the racecourse, was where the bomb had a small contingent, a mini station, with all its accoutrements and so on. And I said, well, the value of the land there is so much, I'd got it from the state agent, and you would save about 100 men. Well worthwhile, more than pay for the message switching device. And the Treasury came back and said, sorry, the land doesn't belong to the Air Force, it belongs to the the government. Belongs to the government, but not the lands agency, I think. And so anyway, Admiral so-and-so, who led the three services signals arrangements, has arranged for you to have dial a teleprinter, which was bloody useless because you spend all day dialing and not getting through.
So the computerised message switching wasn't brought in at this time?
No, the Navy... remember, an Admiral had introduced this dial teleprinter and retired and joined the post office who were providing it. And the Navy took over my STRAD, which is my sending, transmitting, addressing device. Yeah. And we lost out on that for a long time because we'd just spent a small fortune on this dialing nonsense, which was bloody useless.
So what next then? Any other main things before you retire?
Yes, I had a facsimile. I was grateful for facsimile. I put that in a number of stations, but they didn't like it because it meant that the senior officers had to do all their messages in handwriting, and didn't have a typist to